All right, good evening. Welcome. How's that volume doing? Anyone having trouble hearing? Yeah. All right, so for those of you I don't know, I'm Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight, and I'm subbing this month, these 2 weeks for Tewari, and I'll be teaching then in March and April. So we're beginning this year-long exploration of this topic of dependent origination. So I know Tewari talked about that on last month, January, around ignorance and that quality, and then going into the next link in this 12-link series is the sankharas, or the volitional actions. So last week Tewari started this discussion, and we'll see how much of it is a refresher, or how much of it is maybe a different perspective, but hopefully we'll help show a different angle on it that will be helpful for everyone. So this dependent origination is really an exploration of why we suffer, of what creates suffering, what's the origination of suffering, and what's the falling away of that suffering. It's a very elegant, very detailed map of that whole process, of how one link leads to another, how the past influences this present moment, how this present moment influences the future. The sense of suffering is really the second noble truth, is really this is what this is all about. Another way to say it's understanding the process of selfing, how we create this isolated, separate sense of self, which is really analogous to this quality of dukkha, this quality of suffering. So it's a process of seeing how this comes to rise. How does it come to fruition? What factors go into creating this sense of me? What factors go into that creation when we came become born into this self of sense of me? And what happens when that fades? Really, the answer is dukkha, is suffering. So this month we'll be exploring this sankharas, this volitional impulses, volitional activity. And as a resource for this talk, I'm drawing a bit from this great book called Dependent Origination, The Buddhist Law of Conditionality by P.A. Paluta, a Thai monk. And it's actually on our website already. It's under resources, study material related to Dharma Talks. It's one of a series that Rodney did a few years ago. I think, what was it, Lauren? Like,
2013.
Few years ago, 2013, 7 years ago. And so there's some nice resources there that we posted at that time that are still pertinent. Now, before I go into the sankharas, I want to just step back for a second and talk about this interesting concept of conditionality, of cause and effect. And it's one of the key things that the Buddha taught. In fact, it's one of the distinguishing things of Buddhism is this understanding of causality, of conditionality. The Buddha would often sum this up as that when there is this, that is. With the arising of this, then that arises. Okay, so when this one condition arises, it leads to this other thing arising also. And the reverse of that, when this is not, neither is that. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So it's a very, you just boil it down to this formula. But you see it again and again in the suttas. The Buddha would go through, when this is here, then this will happen, and then this will happen. And when this ceases, then the whole chain starts to fall apart. And dependent origination is one of the classic examples of this process. So in dependent origination, when ignorance is a condition, when this sense of not really understanding the nature of what causes suffering, the understanding the laws of impermanence, of dukkha, of non-self, that's the bedrock for ignorance to arise. When ignorance is there, what arises from that is these sankharas, these ways that we express that ignorance. It becomes this way we interpret the world and how we are in the world. And so that's how we act from that. So when ignorance is a condition, there's volitional impulses. With volitional impulses as a condition, then consciousness arises. That's next month. Right? So it's really interesting to see how all these links happen, how they reinforce each other, how they are dependent upon each other. Now, this volitional stuff, this sense of conditionality, I should say, actually has good news and bad news for us. Okay, the good news is that the stuff we take so personally, when we realize we're doing our judgmental pattern again, we're getting reactive again, we're getting triggered again, we often blame that upon ourselves. There's something wrong with me. There's some failing. But actually, from this conditionality, just the past conditions led this kind of pre-programming for this to arise. This painful memory, this mind state, this impulse, it arises based on conditions. So it's true that we had a lot of influence of that conditioning being laid down, but the reasons it comes up is kind of random. You notice this as you start to meditate. I know there's a few people here from the intro class, and you start to realize how random your thoughts really are, that you're sitting and practicing and suddenly you're thinking about something you haven't thought about for 20 years. It just pops up, right? And then it falls away. It's like this randomness of thinking. So it's not something that we created in this moment. It's like our past kind of shaped this to arise in this moment. So it doesn't make sense to judge ourselves for something that's kind of already pre-programmed in. Okay, that's kind of the good news. The bad news, though, is if we start to take that in, we realize I'm not as much control as I think I am. You know, it's like, how many people, when they first started to meditate, thought, yeah, I'll just tell my mind to stop thinking. And I'll just say, focus on my breath. End of story, right? Easy to do. And yet when we try to do it, we realize this mind just has a mind of its own. It's going this way. It's going that way. It's all over the place. And we try to say, how about the breath? And if we're lucky, we're on it for a couple breaths or half a breath before we're distracted again. You know, so we start to realize there's something else that's in our driver's seat. I think this is a lot of our angst, our anxiety, our worry in life, is that we know that we're really not in so much control of things. You know, no matter how hard we try to orchestrate things, it's never quite the way we think it's going to be. This works, dependent origination, it's not just this own mind-body. You can look at it from a societal standpoint. You can look at it from a cultural standpoint, how all these factors come together, influence what arises. So our past conditioning, we sense, has this powerful influence on how we're interpreting this moment. This is going into the next few cycles. How we actually view the world is based on our past conditioning. So you see things like prejudice, you see things like bigotries, things like discrimination. It's like we see the world, this is the implicit bias that we're starting to really realize is so prevalent. It's a way of framing this power of the sankharas, how it shapes our worldview. So when something arises in our meditation or experience, don't hold yourself like, oh, I shouldn't have let this arise. It's already arising. But how you meet it, that is our responsibility. That is really important, the point of power. When I started to really study this this material, years ago, it was just to bring a lot of urgency to this sense of how do I meet this moment. There's a sense of relief that this moment's going to arise how it will. But once it arises, how I meet it is so essential, not only for our practice, but essentially, in the deepest sense, for our well-being. It's so important for how we meet this, for our well-being in the future and in the moment. It's not easy because we're kind of coming against this strong momentum of our history, our past. That's why it's so, the early parts of our meditation, or even years and years, decades later, we get distracted, we get pulled off. Learning to come back strengthens the positive parts of these sankharas, the ones that lead toward freedom versus suffering. More about that later. So how we meet this moment really sets up the conditions for the future. So it's not something we can trace exactly. you know, A leads to B. Sometimes it's that obvious. You know, if I go home and I binge eat a bunch of candy or something and my stomach's all bloated, it's like, why isn't my stomach bloated? I can say, okay, it's because I indulged in that craving. There's a clear cause and effect. It's a little harder when, you know, someone reminds you of your sibling that was so triggering for you, or there, you know, something with your parents or your boss or something that gets triggered. It's like this latent quality that just arises. And we condition ourselves all the time. We create these habits of mind. And I, for a while, I was noticing after a non-residential, I kind of had this craving for something sweet. So then when they're treating, it's like, oh, it's time to get something sweet. It just, you kind of got into that conditioning. I conditioned myself to want that. That's really something, it's nice when, I noticed when at the end of the retreat, the meditation, when I rang the bell, it's a nice practice to let the sound fade completely before you come out of the meditation. Because sometimes we condition ourselves, we hear the bell, okay, it's all over, I can relax. But coming out more gradually with a sense of attending to the sound can be a lovely way of connecting the meditation, making it into the next thing. It brings that quality of attention. So these sankharas, what are they? It's like we have this well of ignorance, this kind of massive ignorance, as Tuari spoke about last month, that tries to express itself in our lives. It's constantly having this impulse. And then again, ignorance we can define as not understanding what's the origination of suffering, what's the cessation of suffering. And when we act with ignorance as a driver, the sankharas are what arises. So an example, kind of an analogy example, you know, with all of these 40 days of rain, 40 days and 40 nights of rain we've had lately. So my backyard sometimes gets really saturated and starts to get little standing pools or big standing pools. And sometimes it comes into my garage. And so I said, okay, I'm going to fix this. So I got out and my pickaxe and started digging a little ditch to help that drain. And would, you know, certainly was a lot of flow coming out. And there's this big pool in the back. So I finally got to that and I opened up the channel so it was just flowing. So, you know, there's this intention to move this water, this intention to actually move this piece of dirt here and kind of shape that channel so it would be floating. And that draining of the water is like the draining of our ignorance. But so often we do this, you know, unintentionally, that we have this well of ignorance and then we act in little ways that cause friction with ourselves and others. That way we judge ourselves, we are self-critical, externally critical, in the way we get reactive. All these patterns, you know, can take very destructive ways, you know, as we get lost in addiction and we struggle with substance abuse. And so this analogy of this channel, it's like I created this channel, so next time it rains, that well of water is going to flow through. We're creating these channels constantly in our own minds, our own lives, in our actions. So volitional impulses, that choice point, that, and sometimes we think of choice and intention as something I'm going to sit down and ponder for a while. Okay, I'm going to really intend to do this. This can happen in moments and seconds, and that reactivity. I think that's often the more pertinent quality of just that reaction that happens before we realize we're already lashing out. I think one of the saving graces of this practice and this process is the sankharas is like this well of ignorance that flows out in our actions for not attending to it, as most of us most of the time aren't. But as we start to practice, not only, you know, in this tradition of Buddhism, but also any really heart-aligned traditions that have heart and wisdom integrated in them, we start to build this well of wisdom, this well of compassion that starts to flow out through our actions. And so then we start to align ourselves with what causes freedom, what causes the unbinding of our hearts. What's an act of generosity, of kindness, of non-harm? And then we act from that well. That starts to change, again, our future outcomes, our future experience. So these sankharas, these volitional impulses, so volitional, like that choice, that intention, and the impulse, the action from that. So it can be of the body, and it could be a impulse to, you know, scratch an itch, to throw a stone, to, you know, reach out, to take, to hit, all these qualities of bodily action. It's like the formations that form around that. It can be verbal. And I think this day and age, we have to include any form of communication. You know, watching my teenage daughter on her cell phone and all the Instagram and Snapchat, all the texting that goes on, that's communication. You know, how often do we send an email and then we wish, oh, I wish I hadn't sent that after we sent it. And it's like, oh, that was too harsh. That wasn't thought through. And it's just like throwing a stone toward a plate glass window and you realize right when you let go, oh, that's a bad idea. And you can't pull the stone back. You send the email and you can't bring it back. You leave the voicemail and you can't bring it back. These are times when our actions are really driven by our ignorance, by hatred, by greed, by delusion. And then mental formations. This is where it gets very subtle. Because sometimes we think, okay, well, I'm not saying anything. I'm not doing anything. I'm okay, right? But I'm sitting silently just, you know, all these thoughts going out of hatred, of fear, of self-discrimination, you know, self-hatred, external hatred, jealousy, all these qualities that we spend so much of our inner dialogue engaging. This is also action. This is also generating these mental formations. This is also expressing our ignorance. As meditators, we have this powerful tool of learning to watch our minds. To start to realize just because we think something doesn't mean it's true. Just because we think something doesn't mean we have to act on it. In fact, we start to have this greater spaciousness. As thoughts arise, we can actually see them arise and having a choice. Just thought something that's worth engaging in. You know? And we have this greater capacity to meet those thoughts of, you know, of our inner pain, of our self-diminishment. You know, of our hurts, of our traumas, of how to meet that with a kindness of heart, with a steadiness of attention. So this volitional impulse, so anytime we choose to follow an impulse, that's the sankharas that are happening. So sometimes it can be very deliberate, but again, mostly it's just this impulse of reactivity. You know, this, and what is that impulse expressing? Is it reactivity? You know, is that one element? Is it when someone says something to you that you find hurtful, do you find yourself lashing back before you even realize what has happened? You know, that's that sense of hearing someone's criticism, you quickly criticize back. Or when someone says something hurtful, do you pause? Do you feel the echoes of that? And then see, okay, what's the compassionate action here? Compassionate for myself and for this other person. How do I take care of my own boundaries, my own sense of emotional, physical safety? How do I care for that? How do I care for the other person, the pain that they're reacting from? You know, so that's the voice of the wisdom coming through versus the voice of the ignorance. And this includes thinking. You know, when I realized that, thinking, it was a little sobering because that means I can't really take a break, right? It's not like I can just, okay, I'm not touching, talking to anybody, I'm okay. It's really the mental formations are so critical. It's really the internal life of dialogue and self-talk just mirrors external. You know, it's a mirroring of that. So tending to ourselves internally, we start to quiet down how we act with other people. working this way, we start to become more and more quiet. That's always a benchmark to notice, is that the way am I practicing, is there more space between my thoughts? Is there a sense of availability, of stillness, of peace that's not so dependent upon the circumstances of my life? Is that starting to become more accessible? And of course, times it goes out the window. It goes out the window and loss and in struggle. But should it start to become more prevalent in those quiet times, those easy times, even the difficult times? So this inner dialogue, that's why I like to emphasize, how we talk to ourselves. The inner critic is so important to start to question, to not keep adding that fuel to that fire. Because it's still an action. It reinforces this ignorance. Because, we have way too much practice in judging ourselves. We've develop that, I think, strongly enough, right? So developing something different, this quality of compassion. So it just digs this deeper and deeper ditch. It ties us to this suffering. So just to kind of pause for a second and kind of summarize where we've been in this talk is looking at this conditionality, the sense of cause and effect. If this arises, then this other thing arises. Okay? And so we've had this, our history of experience, of actions, of choices, our memories, all that kind of comes to bear on how this moment arises. If we act from a quality of ignorance, it tends to have this sankhara quality of reinforcing that ignorance. It expresses it. And the life gives us that feedback. It's like, well, that really hurt, or I hurt. There's suffering. This goes right into the chain of dependent origination that Torrey made in the back wall there, a graphic representation of that. Learning to attend to our words, our actions of body, our actions of mind. So now I'm going to get a little bit more subtle here, if hopefully you'll be with me here. There's different ways of framing this cycle. And one way I found really helpful is in terms of a three-life model. Okay, three-life model. And so I'm not talking necessarily about past life, like reincarnation and future, those kind of things, although I'm not excluding that. But I'm focusing mostly on just this present life, this lifetime that we live. Whether it's from when we're a child to a elder, if we're lucky to live that long, or just the simple sense of this day, or this hour, or how about this minute, or this second. There's this constant way that we're taking birth and falling out. That's why the cycle says, birth, old age, and death. Because this process of taking birth in this sense of self. So the cycle of dependent origination is also known as the wheel of becoming, or the wheel of samsara. The wheel of becoming, or the wheel of samsara. And we can look at the model as covering these three lifetimes, the past lifetime, the present lifetime, and the future. And so ignorance and volitional impulses are all in one lifetime. Consciousness to becoming, so that section of the 12 phases, and then birth to aging and death are the third. Okay, so I know we haven't quite gone into the whole thing. This is something I'll keep coming back to because I find it very helpful personally for practice and also for teaching. So let's say everything that has already happened is in the past, is a past lifetime. Anything that hasn't happened is in the future. And whatever is happening right now is the present lifetime. Okay, pretty simple, right? Everything in the past, even that word I just said, is in the past, right? And the word I say right now is in the present lifetime, and what I will say in a second is in the future. So you can look at it really close, you can look at it more further apart. So past life there's the quality of ignorance and volitional impulses. And this is where they lie. You know, our past ignorance, our past actions have this power in the past. The present life is where we have this sense of consciousness, how we actually sense things through the six senses, the sense of body and mind, of name and form, the sense bases, the point of contact, of feeling, of vedana, and also into craving, clinging, and becoming. And then future goes into that quality of birth, becoming, old age, sickness, and death. Okay, so that's probably way too big of a download, but just, again, focusing just on this quality of the sankharas are this past, this shway, the past is shaping this present, is the main point I want to make. Okay, so that past, you know, certainly includes our childhood, includes our history, our actions, our relationships. You know, it also includes what our ancestors have experienced. You know, there's a way that our ancestral trauma, for example, can go from generation to generation. You know, and so it's like all this stuff comes to bear in this present moment. So this present moment is really the only point of contact that we have access to. Yet it's shaped tremendously by the past. And it tremendously shapes the future. So that's where this point of responsibility of like, wow, I really have to attend to how I'm meeting this moment. This moment does matter, how I meet this. So going with this, again, from this book of Paluta, this quality of the past cause, the past causeway, the past is arriving here, is again, through ignorance, through our past volitional impulses. The present result is how the consciousness, body and mind, sense bases, contact and feeling. So again, this is probably a little bit faster than we can assimilate. But essentially, our past history shapes the very way that we perceive the world, how we label the world, when we say this is that, and how we have a preference for it or not. We like this, I don't like it. You know, and that sets us up into the present cause is we're moving towards something that's pleasant, away from something that's unpleasant. We start to get more invested in that. That's going into this quality of becoming. To the point where, like I say, you know, I really don't like this. I'm going to write a letter. Or I'm going to, you know, I really like this. I want to get more of that. That's going to that form of becoming. That sense of birth. And finally, that fades. So this is just a quick introduction to this idea of past causes, present causes, future effects, past effects. Sankharas and our conditioning come together into this moment. Right? So this moment, how we interact with it, is also a sankhara, but it's more importantly, it's our past history, which is shaping this moment. So how do we work with these? How do we take all these abstract ideas and concepts into something we can have contact with? You know, it comes down to that choice point, that decision of how I'm going to meet this moment. That's what we pointed toward in the instructions. So my wife has this lovely picture when she was probably 5 or 6 at her aunt's wedding. And so she's sitting there, there's this beautiful wedding cake, and she's looking at it. And one of her sister has, you know, like a tender hand on her shoulder, and the other cousin saying, you know, you should go taste it. I mean, it looks like the whole classic, you know, the devil and the angel telling you to do that. And she's kind of like caught between these two. It's a very cute picture. But that's that point of decision. It's like, which way do we go? You know, not framing in terms of heaven and hell, but just framing in terms of what is expressing it. That action, what leads toward, what's coming from ignorance, what's coming from wisdom, and discerning that. So trying to take us off this being just a breath meditation to how it actually attend to our mind, how we actually create this quality of suffering in this moment. So certainly this choice point pertains to some of the more deliberate choices we make. We, you know, often we're trying to align that with our most accessible point of wisdom, trying to be as wise as we can in the choices. Most of us, unless we're, you know, career criminals, aren't like trying to say, well, okay, how can I steal really well? You know, we're not pondering that. You know, it's much more that wisdom that's leading our intentional choices. Yet it's often the kind of, again, that impulsivity, that reactivity, which is so important. Turi has kind of a modern version of the wheel of becoming, how there's different kind of graphic representations of each of these phrases. So traditionally, it's a blind person at the ignorance, like you're just not sure what's present. And she has people with bags over their heads, so they can't actually see what's here. There's not, I think, a clarity. And then this next stage is the sankhara, is that sense of becoming. And she has this wall, this sense of being building a wall, building a prison. So when we don't perceive what's present, you know, that's where the sankharas really come up. Because it's like we're not sure. It's like this edge of our unconscious, this edge of our delusion is clouding our vision. An edge of what's acknowledged, what's owned. And so reactivity, you know, is what arises here. We find ourselves being hooked, being caught, being triggered by this other person, this situation. And then we express our ignorance through that. It's like that channel made in the backyard. The rain comes and the water starts to flow. It comes out in a harsh comment, in a place based in ignorance. As it does it, it reinforces it. Sometimes, you know, that choice point is confused by we're just confused. We're not sure what leads to suffering, what doesn't lead to suffering. You know, a large, obvious example is someone who has struggles with addiction. They're trying to escape pain in some way, pain of their history, pain of their trauma, pain of their minds, and they seek pleasure, right? So it seems like they're alleviating that pleasure, but of course it creates much deeper pain later on. And as our practice matures over the years, that sense of what leads to suffering and what leads to freedom changes. You know, as I look back, when I started to practice, my understanding of that is much different than it is 25 years later. And so it becomes more nuanced. Where is that sense of this leads to freedom, this leads to pain? You know, habit. You're talking a lot about these, you know, that choice point, why it's so hard to go. You know, of course, we've reinforced through habit what's comfortable, what's easy, at least what's familiar. The power of the sankharas, they tend to reinforce what we've always done again and again. It's much easier to go on down that familiar pathway than do something different. Patterns of speech, patterns of action, of mind. There's another sutta called Two Sorts of Thinking from the Majjhimakaya. Whatever a monk or a person or a nun keeps pursuing with their thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of their awareness. Okay, so whatever we keep pursuing with our thinking, with our pondering, that becomes the very shape and inclination of our mind. I mean, the Buddha's describing this part of the sankharas and the link with ignorance or the link with wisdom. You know, we spend so much of our lives caught in our self-doubt or self-reactivity or self-criticism, that becomes the very shape that we view the world. Everything reinforces that. That's why I often, when people ask a question like, should I do this or that? I say, which is less familiar for you? Which is outside of your comfort zone? Because that goes outside of these volitional impulses. This goes outside of your habit. It goes outside your sense of self, the familiarity of that sense of self. There's a greater learning that way. This is one of the significant elements of mindfulness, one of the significant benefits of mindfulness. It slows down this whole process of reactivity so we actually can see what's arising, to actually see that choice point. Because there's a tremendous amount of energy and momentum that we need to overcome. You know, it's really sobering once you start to realize it. It's like, whoa. And especially with patterns of thought, patterns of selfing. But yet, each time we choose to go down a pathway of wisdom and a pathway of compassion, really it's one and the same, we're starting to change those channels. We're trying to change our inclination of mind. We're actually shaping the very way that we perceive the world. In the moment, it may not feel that way, but in the future, you start to see that. And I bet many, if not all of us in the room, have noticed that there's patterns of mind and habits have just started to fall away in some areas of our lives. There's ways that we were reactive that we listen instead. There's ways that our default starts to change. This is the power of sankharas used to express wisdom, our choice points that we come through. You know, during meditation, do we choose to connect with this body, with this breath, or into fantasy, into fear? Or more subtly, are we reinforcing this sense of self, reinforcing that sense of separation, of control? Are we opening to the wonder, the mystery of this moment? In life, am I acting from an open, receptive heart, or contracted, walled away in my beliefs? The sankharas. You know, it's such a point of how we actually choose our own freedom or choose our own suffering. And it happens moment by moment. This moment right here is a choice of suffering or freedom. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments. Let those words settle. And even as we sit, you might get this sense of this impulse, this kind of momentum arising. And what is behind that momentum? Ignorance or wisdom? Simply choosing where we put our energy, where we put our attention. All right, thank you for your attention. I just want to say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week that then we can discuss next week, and then we'll have a chance for any comments or questions that might be out there. So the homework, again, back by the Dana baskets. So the sankharas are these volitional impulses that express ignorance. Right? So to explore this in our practice, start to bring attention to your daily life choice points, areas where you decide what to do one course of action instead of another. Okay, so this can be very simple, very immediate. It's like, okay, I'm choosing, well, let's say I'm meditating, I would decide to go into this fantasy or come back to my breath. That's a choice point. When I'm responding to an email or text or Instagram or Snapchat, whatever I'm doing, to notice what is behind that. You know, what am I expressing? A hurt? Or am I expressing a quality of compassion? And start to notice what happens when you choose to connect with your heart, to choose to connect with your wisdom. So you might try to discern this right in the moment of the choice point, or it might be 10 minutes later after you've already created all this havoc. It's like, oh boy, let me look at that a second. And remembering to broaden the definition of action to not just what you say or how you communicate, not just what you do with your body, but what you think. What you think. The next time you have that self-deprecating thought, that's a choice point. Do you add another thought to that? Or do you meet that with wisdom and compassion? Very challenging. but very, very fruitful. All right, so are there any comments or questions out there? And we experimenting with a mic. It's our first time, second time we've ever had a mic.
There we go.
Yes, okay.
Most of what is I'm hearing being described as being dependent on past experience, perceptions, prejudices, enculturation, whatever,
yes,
leads me to say there's no such thing as free will, but then you're using the words volitional choice point decision,
yeah,
after you've described conditions which demonstrate there's no such thing as free will.
Yes, so the comment is around, really around free will, and you know, is there free will, and especially considering all of these, this momentum of our past and how it really affects what arises in this moment. And I was preparing this talk, I said, I hope no one asks me about free will. So we just get it off out of the way right off the bat. So free will is an area that's quite debated in Buddhist circles. You know, there is, there isn't. You know, there's kind of that quality. And for myself, I mean, the way I would frame it is simply that, again, this moment arises and it's already kind of preconditioned to do that. We can't track those conditions. They're so complex. Sometimes it's, you know, it's obvious, like, well, that person looks just like my sister. And, you know, I get really charged when, you know, it's like I'm already pre-biased. I'm like a, it's almost like a steel trap that's kind of, the spring is loaded and you just need someone to step on it and boom, it goes out there. So in that way, it is kind of preconditioned. But the sense of not having free will, I think, is, to me, then why would we practice? It's like that sense of, how do I meet this moment? There is that choice of where do I go into that? They may argue that the capacity to meet that comes from past conditioning too. And then it's like, comes like those movies with the past and future, you know, traveling, and your head starts to hurt. And so, you know, practice always has to be very practical from my perspective. And so pondering that stuff, does it lead to clarity and ability to engage in the practice or not? And for me, I haven't really found it very helpful to consider that. I just know that this moment is preconditioned. It's kind of preset how it arises, but how I meet it, there is that choice of where I put my energy. I mean, anyone who's tried to meditate and has come back from being lost in thought again and again, there's a volitional action that's happening there. And that starts to transform in a way that once there starts to be a real openings in that illusion of self, then there's something that's beyond conditioned, that's not dependent upon past condition. You know, it's rising much more spontaneously with what's present, what's here. All right, thank you. Anyone else? Callie, right behind you there, where you can, we'll kind of sweep around the room here. Yes.
I don't fully understand the difference between a volitional impulse and a mental formation. Could you say again what you said?
Sure.
To help us understand better what the difference is between those things, if they're different or are they the same? Because Tuareg was mostly talking about mental formations.
Yes. So how was she talking about the formations?
I was very unclear.
Okay.
So volitional impulse is easier for me to understand,
sure,
but I'm just not sure if it's the same or if there's a subtle difference.
Yeah. Yes, it's a great question with, you know, mental formations versus volitional impulses. Are they the same? Are they different? How does that all fit together? So I'm going to see if I can get a little bit more reading about that question, because I actually, if you listen to my talk, I kind of skipped over that point. It's like I skipped over. You guys are hard tonight. I skipped over the free will. You can see all the holes in my presentation. But, you know, typically, you know, again, this one very lovely book. That this book, by the way, is very lovely, but it's also very thick and heavy too. So you might fall asleep a few times while you're reading it, if you're like me, till you really get it. But anyway, so back, usually he would put those both together. There's a way that they're analogous. But if I was going to just talk, you know, off my sense of that, those two words. So volitional is that sense of action, that sense of choice. So, and a lot of it has to do with that intention. Intention may not be very conscious. It may be more, you know, I'm getting hurt, so I'm going to hurt you, that kind of a thing. But there's still that intention. So that's where that volitional impulse piece comes in. The formations, we could say, are more of the kind of the shape of our mind that's kind of been created through our past history. You know, so you might have, and it's often very conditioned, right? So if you've been meditating a while and you come into a darkened room and everyone's sitting quietly, it's like, ah, you know, that's the mental formation that arises. Like, oh, it's time to meditate. I like the stillness. If you've never meditated before and you come into a darkened room and everybody looks like they're comatose, you have a different mental formation that kind of loads. And then from that loading of that shape, that's when we act from. So it's kind of this kind of positionality, this sense of perspective that I take. We can almost look at it as a kind of the sense of self and all the premises that that's based on. So I interpret the world in that way. Does that kind of make sense? And then from that formation, then I do the volitional activities, like the outward expression of that. I might have a different answer next week, but that's what I have this tonight. Yeah, good. Yeah, Iris has something.
I think it was when Philip was here in December. And this is related a little bit to the free will thing. And if folks were there, maybe you can help me articulate what I think I'm remembering. About, it had to do with mindfulness, and since we've been practicing mindfulness for X number of years, how come we're not more mindful? And so the idea that choice point is so quick, it can go by so quickly. You know, so like for me, like I'll see it and it's very easy for me to ignore it because of conditioning. Mm-hmm. So in order to assert any kind of free will, I have to really want to. I mean, my intention has to be strong to when I wake up in any moment, to make the wiser of the choices in front of me, to like really pay attention. And I was thinking yesterday that I need to limit my reliance on my screens, on my computer, because that is my go-to. I finish doing anything, and it's kind of like I'm looking for some comfort and relief. Yeah. Let me open my laptop, check my email, yeah, or the news, and it's like a comfort thing. And I thought, well, maybe don't do it. I haven't not done it, but that choice point goes so quickly.
Yeah, so not to talk about, I miss Philip's, you know, retreat, and it's always, it's hard to interpret what another teacher, you know, because they have their own perspective and their own way of framing it, so. But just answering, you know, what you said, that choice point being, it goes by so quickly, how can you really do anything with it? There's so much momentum around it, it's hard to get any kind of foothold around it. So what to do? And we've been mindful for so many years, why aren't we better at it? So this is what I would say, and this is, I'll borrow this from Christina Feldman, that mindfulness doesn't just travel by itself. It travels with its friends. Okay, so I think when we're trying to be just mindful, if we really look at it, it's like we're doing it on a very, we're doing it from this premise of separation, for one. Our view isn't quite, isn't fully there. There's a sense of me having to do something, me notice this experience, me notice this breath. Okay, and then going back to your example of the screen time, trying to take a break from that, and you say, okay, well, that's not good to do. I want to step back, and you have a sense of that loneliness. So what I'm trying to say is that with mindfulness, you know, I think it just by itself, it's not so helpful. What we really need is also the quality of investigation to bring it, you know, to just really simplify it. So when I say by investigation, is almost having this much more accurate, precise contact with really what is the root of this. And I think so often we get caught in the superficiality of it. It's like being in an argument with a friend and you're just going back and forth and no one's ever acknowledging the much deeper hurt that may go back for, you know, years. And once you acknowledge that, though, then suddenly this thing starts to fall away. And so there's the twofold. Is really the acknowledgement, the deep precision of what's the really the most tender piece here, like the sense of loneliness. If you bring your attention to that with a quality of compassion, the steadiness, you're finding that the impulse to try to overcome it through screen time gets transformed. It's the impulse of what causes our suffering. But at the same time, very important to notice what causes our liberation, to be really, really attuned to that. And when we start to be attuned to that, it's no longer me trying to be mindful. It's like mindfulness just moves through you naturally. And so much of it is these really deep premises of self and other, of separation. I mean, this is like the bedrock of ignorance. It feels like it's, you know, it's like that's the earth I stand on. And investigation, mindfulness, faith, all, you know, the seven factors, you know, all these things we've talked about over these years, the paramis, all help us, support us to start to see through that bedrock of self. When that bedrock falls away, we're kind of in free fall. There's not that sense of ground that we can rely on. And yet then suddenly mindfulness, it's like it's not us doing it. It was just simply, we just step out of the way and there's the natural knowing. Another way to say it is, instead of me trying to be mindful, I actually step back to that sense of knowing that's already present. It's already receiving the moment. And we just kind of jump on there and say, oh, I'm being mindful. I just kind of take a cup of water from the ocean and say, this is my cup. Instead of realizing it's always, as all water is tending back to the ocean.
Hello, I'm new, so hopefully I don't get too nervous what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, I had a feeling. Can yes. You hear me now?
Yes, that's great.
Okay, so I was thinking about what you were saying about conditioning.
Yes.
And I have a challenge with negative self-talk.
Yes.
And I think when you think about, I always thought, well, there is this concept that I'm conditioned. I have, when you said conditioning, I thought about how you get conditioned by like how your parents talk to you, and then when your parents die and they're not there to say these negative things to you anymore, you're still continuing that dialogue.
Right.
But I think it's more than that. You're arguing with a dialogue of your parents. You're arguing with their parents' dialogue.
That's right.
And all of the dialogue before that.
That's
so
right. Yeah.
That is quite a team to be arguing against.
It is, yeah.
But it can be a struggle, but like when I'm meditating, when these thoughts come in, I kind of have this not now, I'm busy kind of attitude.
Yeah.
And then you get back to it. And that's pretty much all I have.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. That's well articulated. it's like the momentum of, like you were using the example of that internal dialogue of self-criticism, how we learn that from our parents, and they'd learn it from their parents, and it just goes back and back, and there's all these cultural and societal influences get, you know, reinforced. So it's not just our self-talk, it's really our self-belief, right? That's because if we didn't believe it, like if our parents said, you know, the sky is green, it would be like, okay, that he's just crazy. But they say something that we believe, even though it is as crazy as the sky is green, but we believe it is true because they believed it is true. So it's like this deep transmission, because, you know, when you're a kid, it's like you are your parents. Like you just depend upon them for survival. And so you just absorb those beliefs. That creates that hardened sense of self. The saving grace of that, though, is that if you work with it, you start to see eventually that it's just a thought. And then suddenly it's like, wow, this is a thought that it's, when you see that, it's like, oh my gosh, I've believed my whole life that this thought is true. And it's not even true. And suddenly it's like, there's this, it's like, oh, then you start to put your parents to rest. And not only your parents, you put, you know, your all the lineage of that. And then there's this gift into the future of your children and everybody you contact. And that's why I think it's so, I mean, the dependent origination has that, is a beautiful way to look at it from, you know, from generations and how we reinforce our trauma, or we can also interrupt that. And it's so beautiful to see someone doing that in their life. And the momentum, they say, okay, I'm not going to keep following that. It's so powerful. And it's a process, you know. As for most of us, we have to first learn the difference between our thoughts and our breath, our body. We have to find some contact. But once that's established, then we start to, when those thoughts arise, you start to actually see it without so believing in it. You say, okay, well, maybe the thought just, you know, I'm going to suspend the belief in it a little bit. Doing that sometimes makes the pain more intense because you feel more directly. I remember when I started practice, I would have the thought like, okay, I'm such a terrible person. I'm never going to be any good. I'm always going to be a failure. And I would just go on and on and on. And eventually I started to notice the thought arise, that whole system load in, that mental formation that we talked about, and then the volition that comes out of that. I would start to say, I'm such an idiot. And then I would stop. It's like as soon as I started to become aware of it, I could drop and come back into my body. Come back with compassion. And eventually it would become shorter and shorter. I'm such a, you know, as soon as I started to feel myself go that way, it's like, okay, I am, and it would fall away. And then to the point where you just see, that's just a thought that arises. And sure, you know, there's times when it's going to get triggered, you know, because it's a tender place in you, that the right condition, the right person comes around, it's going to come up. But it comes up much less strongly, much less of a duration. Yeah, so I think it's one of the most important things for us to do is to learn to meet that voice with kindness, with compassion, and see it as just your parents, you know, they didn't know any better. They loved you the best they could, and this is one of the things they gave you. You can learn to set that aside. But yeah, it takes patience, it takes a lot of compassion, and it takes a lot of companionship. Yeah, thank you. Hard to follow that question. Anyone else? Hi, Janet.
Hi. This is the first time I've ever spoken in any of your classes or any of this.
And with a mic, too.
Good. Just following along with what was just said, I've been coming to these this year and made the commitment. And over the years, as I learn how to practice meditation, I feel like I'm starting to see things differently, but it happens slowly. Like last night, I was looking at a photo and for my sister for Valentine's Day, and I saw a picture of myself, and I started telling the story of why I look sad. And then I realized I've been even seeing this picture incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually I can see I'm being told not to suck my thumb, and I sucked my thumb for a long time, mm-hmm. and it's all the things we talked about today as well, of coping with narratives that... and so I guess I don't really have a question. That's why I haven't asked a question. I just feel like I just have to keep listening and let this unfold. And there's no way to speed it up, or it'll just happen sometimes. And today I found myself suddenly seeing, you know, I'm 50, almost 55, and just sort of seeing this story I told.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, and the courage to speak up. I'm one of the people who doesn't like to ask questions in the class. You know, that sense of, patience, allowing things to be at their own time, own pace, is so helpful. And it's also really helpful, too, to connect, connect like that's a beautiful story. You see a picture and all this stuff loads up with it. Beautiful example of sank, maybe not beautiful, but it's a powerful example of the sankhara is coming to bear on this moment's interpretation. It's like suddenly all that stuff is, it's just like this tidal wave that's coming at you. So finding a place of grounding, connecting with the breath, the body, where's the feet, touching that tenderness, the deep tenderness in that. And then here's a way to speed it up, it's like, it's to be more, like the last question with Iris is that sense of precision. What am I actually believing here? Because so often a lot of this stuff is so, it's so unconscious, it's kind of this, but it's so powerful. And we start to actually give voice to it, we actually articulate it, look at it enough to say, I wasn't enough, I wasn't loved, I wasn't okay like I was. That sense of giving voice to that takes it from this kind of nebulous quality to this more clear thing. And then in that point of clarity, you can say, okay, that you start to see that was then, and this is now. You know, I can see why I believed that then, but I can also see that I recalibrate for this present moment. This work is really about freeing the past. I'm sorry, freeing the future, freeing the present from the past. I mean, that's a way to sum up this whole talk. As the sankharas present themselves, this momentum of our past, learning to start to free that. It's hard work, but it's also, it's like the only work to do. All right, yes.
I'm new to meditation, but for many years I spent time working with other people to work on the emotions attached to all this stuff in the past. And for me, releasing those emotions, letting myself feel them, was very freeing.
Yes.
And I cried for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. So, to me, it seems very difficult to free yourself in just this intellectual way. I mean, there's all this emotion, and it was very profound for me.
Yes.
So, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
Sure, yeah. So, the comment is around trying to free ourselves from an intellectual standpoint doesn't seem to really meet the emotional reality of the tenors, the tears, the sorrow, the pain, the fear, all those qualities. And, this tonight's talk is really about this, in some ways, an intellectual way of understanding, kind of framing this process of suffering. But it's certainly... that's not the way I would say practicing is. If you just stayed in the intellect, it's like, oh, that's your sankharas. It's very limited. As you said, it's like you really have to, that willingness to turn toward your experience, like we were talking about last Thursday, that turning toward with kindness, and asking what's there. And so that's really the movement of the heart toward experience. So this is a framing of all the power, the momentum of our lives. But in this moment, which is the only point of power, our hearts have to really meet that. And as we meet it, if we meet it really in a careful, kind way, there is often that flowing of the tears of so many years, which you weren't able to feel, you weren't safe to feel. It starts to flow out. And in that way, you're freeing the past in that. So, yeah, by no means, we shouldn't just stay in our heads. Yeah. So thank you for asking that.
Well, lately I look back into like one of my parents' lives for this conditioning, examining that conditioning and
yes.
thinking about what I know now about my parents, you know.
Yes.
And it's just very interesting. Some of it is I can see that some of it is conditioning they got, some of it is that what my parents did as a couple, what their life, but it's interesting when I remove the emotion and just look at their life, you know, and what they did, and yeah. not necessarily what they said, but their actions too. And it's very, to contemplate that for me can be very liberating, because then I can remove a lot of the emotional stuff around that conditioning and decide which parts were really good conditioning and which parts were just random, you know, things that they got that, you know. And I just, is that what we, part of what is going on here is to just examine the conditioning, whether it's parental or some other conditioning, and then I have the choice of deciding which parts I want, you know, so it's right, really yeah. nice that way.
Yeah, so the question is around kind of, you know, how much do we have to map out our conditioning and see where, you know, is that part of this practice?
Like deconstructing.
Yeah, deconstructing. I'd say that, I mean, this is kind of the interface, this interesting interface between therapy and psychological work and Dharma work. And, you know, for me, the big delineation is with Dharma work, we're starting to investigate this sense of self, the sense of who I take myself to be. A big part of that is the emotional, psychological work. And, you know, for different people, it takes different shapes of how we explore that. I think sometimes when it's really feels entrenched and really kind of solid, you know, starting to unpack it can be very helpful. Sometimes it's some of the questions we've answered about turning toward it with that real, you know, that really careful listening. I said precision, but that might be too clinical. That sense of that deep listening for the heart of the hurt. Okay. Other times it might be like, as it worked well for you, is to say, okay, I'm going to just kind of take my emotional stuff out of it and just notice, you know, the conditions of our lives and how they did what they did and the choices and how that, you know, formed me. And that way, that it's the same process as like being more clear about it. Taking something that's kind of nebulous, kind of confused, that's lost in delusion and confusion, and making some clarity. You know, whether the head leads or the heart leads, it's still leading. Yes. Yes, you start to have compassion for your parents and appreciation for them. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. And I think that's, like, you know, the causation, you know, is noticing, you know, when I relate to this experience in this way, does my heart open? And if it's opening and you're feeling that sense of availability, that's a good way to go. Yeah. Maybe one more question if there's... Sometimes you only can squeeze so much water out of the sponge there. Okay, good. So next week, I'll look forward to having more of a discussion around this topic. I'll do a shorter talk and have a chance for some small group interaction around it, and then see what questions arise. So yeah, be curious this week. Notice that touch point. There's a lot of beautiful refinements that came from the questions. So thank you all for asking those. All right, so have a lovely evening, and a couple quick